Well, if you're a regular listener, you know we've covered the topic of concussion previously. Dr. Brian Rieger, Assistant Professor of Rehabilitation Psychology at SUNY Upstate, has joined us previously to talk about concussion, in particular sports-related concussion. He's joining us again this morning to discuss a recent headline that really points out the importance of this discussion. Good morning, Dr. Rieger.
Good morning, Tricia.
And welcome back. Let me tell our listeners about the news story, and then we can talk more about it because I know you have insight. Listeners, the article is addressed to a brain donation program at Boston University and the announcement that a dozen athletes, including six NFL players and a woman soccer player, have now agreed to donate their brains for study after they die to help researchers better understand what happens to the brain with injuries. The interest on the part of these athletes is for science to study the long-term effects of concussion, or as we have said before on this show, it's not just a bump on the head. Dr. Rieger, as I understand it, their interest is in proving that concussion does cause long-term effects, and that's been your experience, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly one of the largest concerns that I guess in one of the biggest questions that remains unanswered. Many people for years have had the sense that among boxers or football players who've suffered repeated concussions, that there does seem to be some risk of accumulating damage that can result in long-term problems. And the National Center for Sports Injury Research in North Carolina has published a couple of studies. Researchers there have been part of a couple of research teams that have found a greater incidence of both dementia and depression in retired NFL football players who have histories, who report histories of multiple concussions. So studies like that continue to raise serious questions about what the long-term risks might be, even when an athlete may appear to recover from a particular concussion.
Well, and that's one of the things about concussion is you can't really see that somebody's injured. It could be an injury, I suppose, like spraining your wrist or, you know, breaking your leg. But since we can't see it, we tend to send athletes back into the game too quickly, don't we?
We're always combating this fact that concussion is an invisible injury, and really in more ways than one. First of all, the person often looks perfectly fine. They don't have a big bandage wrapped around their head. They don't have a cast on.
Right, and they're not falling down necessarily.
And they're not falling down necessarily.
Right?
So we can't see it that way. And also, we don't have a blood test or, in many cases, even a radiological study that can detect the effects of concussion. So a CT scan and, in many cases, an MRI will be normal, even though we know that there are some problems in brain functioning.
We do. Now, one of the people who is donating his brain is a gentleman named Ted Johnson. He's a former New England Patriots linebacker. And he said he was donating his brain in hopes that Center at Boston University can clarify these long-term effects. Now, he's had his own problems with post-concussion injuries. And he even had to leave the games, didn't he? He had to stop being a New England Patriot.
Yes, he's not able to play football anymore because he's continuing to suffer from what he and others believe are the effects of repeated concussions.
And what kinds of problems is he having?
He has very significant mood problems, so he's very depressed and irritable. He has difficulties in his thinking. He has headaches and fatigue. That's my understanding from the reports that I've seen.
And evidently, these are really changes in his personality, aren't they?
Certainly. And one of the things notable about the Ted Johnson story was that he really came forward with his story after an autopsy of another NFL player, Andre Waters, who killed himself.
Yes.
Showed that he had the brain of an 80-year-old, even though he was somewhere around 40. I don't remember exactly. And Ted Johnson came forward and said, hey, he's not the only one.
Yeah.
And gave his own story and talked about, you know, how in professional football, both athletes and teams and coaches all conspire to minimize the effects of injury because of pressures to play, economic pressures. But certainly, as a person who's now living with the effects of multiple concussions, he seems to want to do something to raise awareness about that.
You know, I know that we watch football, every weekend, especially this time of the year, and we see these athletes, they fall and they hurt a knee or they hurt an arm or something like that. They're escorted off the field, and then we hear that, okay, they're not going to be back in the game for 6 weeks, and everybody says, oh, because he hurt his leg. But when somebody has a concussion, that just is not the attitude.
It certainly has not been the attitude for many years. There has been an international consensus for about 7 years now that no athlete should return to the current game or practice after a concussion.
And that doesn't matter whether the athlete is a 30-year-old football player or a 10-year-old on
no,
a field
these,
on a Saturday
these,
afternoon.
These are consensus guidelines from international experts. And the NFL has come around to adopting that position mm-hmm. over time. But it's really changing the attitude and the culture in terms of our understanding about concussion. Taking every concussion seriously, just because it doesn't look bad on the field, doesn't mean it might not have bad consequences later on, and especially in a sport where there's the risk of repeated injury.
And so now we have these athletes who are stepping forward saying, yes, we believe that this really is a bigger problem than everybody realizes, and we are going to make this sacrifice upon our death that you can look at our brains. What do you think they're going to find?
Well, I think that's a good question. What's striking about the article that was in the Times at the end of September that prompted this conversation was that the lead researcher at Boston University notes that, okay, we've only had a small number of people, like 5 or 6, who've donated their brains, but every single one of them, we found evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Ah, CTE. Meaning,
CTE, exactly. Meaning that they found evidence of progressive decline in brain functioning, neurofibrillary tangles, and other things that we see in people with dementia mm-hmm. or age-related changes in the brain. Mm-hmm. And these have been beyond what would be expected for someone their age. So she said, okay, it's a small number of people so far, but we're batting 1,000.
Yes.
And so it's pretty persuasive that there might be something to this.
Well, there's clearly more to this story, and I'm sure we'll hear more as time goes on. I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I'll be glad to, Tricia. Thank you.
Dr. Brian Rieger, thank you so much.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's Checkup from the Neck Up. Follow the leader, or if I were president, I'd... Well, dear listeners, there I was, walking into the lobby of our local high school to vote, and I found a glittering, luminous moment. A young African-American woman right in front of me, her young son annoying her as our kids used to do by yanking on her sleeve over and over, then both of them stepping into the booth. A minute later, they emerged, her a brown Mona Lisa, floating by, glowing from within with joy, pride, hope. And the next morning, after we Americans had swept aside stereotypes centuries old to elect an African American to the White House, I was feeling and hearing others feeling a never-felt-before feeling of gentle camaraderie between us Americans of all colors, on the street, in the office, everywhere, as if whispering to each other, wow, look what we've done, together, who'd have thunk it? Now the question is, after the afterglow of this stellar national achievement, can we keep the glow going? From years of working with groups, I know that no matter how effective, how smart, how articulate, how persuasive, how hardworking a leader, if the group's members don't continually work alongside, the group goes nowhere. So it falls to us, the citizens of our not red, not blue, but United States, to work with President-elect Obama to build on this gentle camaraderie and continue making our day-to-day relationships and thus our country what we now know the American dream can really be. But how? Well, President-elect Obama showed us and told us the way. You know how on the campaign trail and in the debates with Senator McCain, he showed an unusual calm and focus on his message and goal? This was especially apparent when someone took an unfair, unkind, or provocative swipe at him personally. What did he do? If we look closely, we'll see that over and over he ignored the personal element of the attack, knowing such attacks are not really about him, but actually about the other person failing to contain their frustration. And he refused to respond in kind. Instead, listened for the message under the attack, and then responded on task, with respect for the other and with the best interests of everyone, the country as a whole, in mind. The challenge is the same for us in our day-to-day lives with each other. In short, The formula for relationship-transforming conversation is, unless there's personal danger, ignore attacks and our primal instinct to retaliate. Instead, listen, especially, as Obama said, when we disagree. Understand and respond with the other's message in mind, working towards a solution that we all can live with. While election day dramatically demonstrates that we can't all be president, we can all act a bit more presidential. And just maybe that will be enough to keep the healing glow glowing. I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for listening.